You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to the Battle Bridge, take two. A TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation and some things that have nothing to do with Star Trek The Next Generation. I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And I'm James from London.
James from London. I remember I said last week we may have a guest on?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I got bad news, buddy.
Okay. I already know what's happened. So how? Well, you're yeah. going down a bad news avenue? Why is that?
He's here. Mr. Data, introduce yourself.
Hey, guys. I'm with you, James. Why is Lou considering me bad news now? Have I been away too long?
You have been gone way too long, sir. The last time we had you was on Season 4, Episode 15, First Contact with Mark Stamper. That's the last I show you.
Hang on a second. So that was also a Prime Directive episode as well.
Yeah, that's definitely my thing. That was a nice, good version of one, and this is a not so nice one.
No.
Okay, actually, so this is the thing. I've always been a little bit don't particularly care for this episode, but when I heard that you were coming on, Data, I rewatched this thinking, look, there's going to have to be something there. There's something clever going on. I'm going to have to be on my game because otherwise no one's going to have requested this one, right? I'm slightly heartened to hear that you think it's not quite as good at least as First Contact.
Right. Yeah, I've just... So it has been a while. I've just been busy in my life. I used to work for the U.S. Navy. Over the last couple of years... Since we last talked, I retired from that. My wife and I are basically retired now, but we both own small companies and we do different things. She focuses on her background, like in measuring things, metrology, the science of measuring things. I focus on helping people get retired, like me, in their mid-40s. So I do... financial advising, that kind of stuff. That's the primary thing I do now. I'm also a parliamentarian, very interested in how to run organizations, how to make decisions, those kind of things. Those are my background and the Prime Directive kind of concepts and fairness.
Yeah. If only they would teach common sense in schools here. I don't know about over there, James. I mean, do your public school system, do they teach things like, you know, credit, how to deal with credit, how to get it, use it responsibly, how to save for retirement, and so on?
Yeah, I mean, a little, but I'm not necessarily sure that would come under common sense, right? Yeah.
you would think it should come under common sense. Well, I actually, you know, I know it's another tangent, I'm sorry, but I actually got in an argument with one of my daughter's high school teachers when they were talking about credit and how you get credit and how you use credit and how it can help you get things in life. And I said, well, okay, so when do you teach them about retirement accounts? Well, we don't. So what you're saying is the only thing you teach them is how to get in debt and how to stay in debt and worship at the altar of the credit score. That's all you teach them? Nothing about if they put 10, 15% away from age 18 to age 65 that they would be multimillionaires? Nothing like that? No, we don't teach that. Mm-hmm. I'm like, now that is sad. That is sad.
I think even if they do start teaching some of the general concepts, I think what I find a lot is that people were taught something, or their parents taught them something. Their parents told them, hey, here's how I succeeded, or something like that. Or you find an older person in the last generation who did well and you ask them. But then that's still a problem because tax laws change all the time. Sure. And so I'm constantly talking to people who are still thinking the way to get to retirement is the way that used to work back in the 1970s, right? And not realizing new innovations like Roth IRAs and other types of new annuity products and different things that have come on the market that your parents aren't aware of.
Agreed. Absolutely. They had no idea because they got pensions after working 25 years. So, yeah, you're right.
Let me ask a question. In the U.S., where do they get pensions from? Do you have a concept of having pension from your employer?
Yes. It's not a social program like our Social Security is. It's actually an employer-driven one. You'd still contribute out of your paychecks. This here, maybe James – not you, James. Maybe Data will be able to help me on this because my understanding is they're still going to pull money out of your account. It goes into their pension program, and when you retire, you're set for life. They'll pay you out of your pension for the rest of your life. But am I right, Data, that they would take it out of your paycheck just like a 401k?
Generally, yes. But it depends. There's lots of variances, like I say, and things change over time, right? The model of the company taking a little bit of money or just paying you less and in exchange guaranteeing you a pension later in life, that's becoming less and less the norm, right? Only like really old, established, large corporations are still doing that. Most corporations have gone to the 401k concept where they're not guaranteeing a pension. They're just guaranteeing a certain amount of benefit, like a matching contribution.
Yep. Yep.
No, by the way, that's something that happened in the UK in terms of the a defined benefit kind of structure over to defined contributions. I should mention that in my day job, not necessarily as much now, but used to be, I'm very familiar with the UK pension legislation and also the actuarial projections behind determining valuations and things like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, over the last 25 years, there's been a risk transfer from employers over to employees in terms of who takes that risk. Now, right. There's nothing necessarily. Okay, you can make an argument about who is best placed to take that risk. That's one thing. But you can almost like park that for a second. One of the things that has happened as that risk did get transferred from the employees over to the employer over to the employee is that the actual cost of the servicing went. It's about a quarter of what it used to be. By which I mean. The amount someone's prepared to put into a defined contribution scheme is probably nowhere near the amount that they should have put aside for a defined benefit pension scheme. So this is just a long way of saying that defined benefit pension schemes were insanely generous, or at least they always had been with the UK, which effectively meant that they've kind of just eaten themselves and... they're not open to new members. It's extremely hard to find anything that's still going at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, I certainly didn't really expect to talk about this kind of stuff today. I thought we were going to be talking more about Star Trek and the Prime Directive. But surprisingly enough, I think this will come back. I think it relates. This idea of who's making the decision and who's taking the risk.
Yeah.
It does relate.
Yeah. All right, then. So there we go. All right. Homeward, huh? Let's see. Excuse me. Oh, by the way, I got my second COVID shot. Yay! Homeward. The synopsis for tonight's episode is Worf's foster brother, comma, whom we've never heard about, comma, violates the Prime Directive by saving a group of villagers from a doomed planet. This is the 13th episode of Season 7, It was first aired on January 17th, 1994. Teleplay by Naren Shankar, story by Spike Steingrasser, and directed by Alexander Singer. Guest stars for tonight's episode is Paul Sorvino as Nikolai Rozhenko. And if you don't know him, I think he's from one of the CSI or Law and Order, isn't he?
Data? Sopranos.
Sopranos! That's right, Sopranos.
That's his big show. I mean, I'm sure he's some other stuff.
That's it. And he might even be in The Irishman, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know about that, but seems like every possible mob man show movie star is in The Irishman. So, guest stars. Penny Johnson as Deborah. Penny Johnson. The same Penny Johnson?
I did not remember that, by the way, but it was quite pleasant to see her there.
Yeah, yeah. Brian Markinson as Vorin, Edward Penn as Kateras, and guest stars Susan Christie as Tarana, and Majel Barrett as the voice of the computer. So what do we think about this episode? Data? Jump.
I was just thinking, does that mean both of Penny Johnson's Star Trek characters ended up pregnant? That's interesting.
Hmm.
So I find this episode really troubling for the messages that it's trying to portray. I appreciate that that brings up some questions, but it's also a sign of how Star Trek has changed over the years and maybe why. A big part of why the original series philosophy was better than Next Gen. But we'll get more into that. Also, you know, the use of a family member yet again. It's like a seventh season trope now, right? Let's bring all the family members out of the woodwork. Just to have some supposed drama, which isn't great. So.
Okay. James, how about you?
Yeah, so actually, I think I mentioned it a bit earlier. I kind of completely forgot about what this episode was. I know it's like the quote-unquote Worf's brother episode. To me, the Worf's brother part of it didn't appear to be that interesting to me. I mean, they had a few squabbles, but that's about it, right? I didn't feel like there was any reason to care. And I have no reason why, you know, why it could have, this could have just worked just as well with Worf's, you know, uncle or third cousin or whatever. It didn't, to me, it didn't feel like it quite connected. But actually, overall, I thought this was more pleasant. I mean, I enjoyed the watch more than I thought I was going to, because, yeah, I think some of the stuff that comes up in season 7 is a little bit poorer than previous seasons. But I'm interested to have the discussion with Data about the issue around the Prime Directive, because kind of watching this episode made me kind of think, why don't they just have an entire fleet of starships to take care of situations like this? You know, to me, it felt like what Nikolai was doing in the end was admirable and can be done with relatively low risk, right? I don't know if we're going to get into the discussion about, well, you can't intervene, otherwise what happens if you intervene and causes the next Hitler? I think that's a tired, kind of not particularly... appropriate argument. So I don't understand why they don't just set up these fleets to go around and save planets about to become extinct. I mean, this was a pretty horrendous situation this village was facing. And yeah, I look forward to that discussion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. For me, Worf foster brother. That's almost enough said. Actually, this is just a revisit of Drama 4. Okay, Sarzenka. Remember her?
And actually, I couldn't quite remember what Data ended up doing. But yeah, doesn't he basically do exactly the same thing?
Pretty much. But however, he was ready to let them die because Picard said, you will sever the link to Drama 4. He walks over to the computer and he sets it up. Starts to disconnect the link. But of course, the computer needs a few seconds to actually isolate the frequency. And in that time, you get this little girl pleading for help. And that changes Picard's mind. this is just a rehash, only Picard didn't get his mind changed. He got it changed for him. And then it seemed like once Nikolai did what he did, then Picard's like, well, okay, you've already done it, so now we're in it. We have to do what we have to do. I guess what would have been the alternative? Beam him back onto the planet? I mean, they would have had the same thing happen to him 20 minutes earlier.
Obviously, yep. That would have been it would have been a slightly different moral act, right? They would have been taking positive action to kill people who were still alive instead of just allowing them to die. That's certainly going to come up in our discussion, the difference between a moral obligation and just something that, like, is morally praiseworthy, but not necessarily required, right? So that distinction might come up, I'm certain.
Nothing like the present. Dude, I cannot possibly sit up in space and watch a planet. And they all just sit there and watch the planet dissolve itself. And, well, yeah. There's, you know, it's too bad we couldn't have done more. So, well, hey, it's time to go. I don't know how they could do it. Directive or not, prime directive or not, I don't know how it's possible. But on the other hand, should Nikolai have done what he did?
Well, we're just jumping right in, right?
That's what we usually sometimes do.
Okay.
Well, it's an 800-pound elephant in the room.
No, but before we get on to that, I do have to say the, there's the bit where they open and they say, oh, we're being contacted by Worf's brother, which seems a bit of a, it's a bit of, straight diving in there, right? They don't even think, we're being contacted by scientists or a group of scientists, which is what I would have imagined there would have been there. But there's a bit where Picard kind of tells Worf, said, Worf, you can go down and sort him out, but I first need you to be, altered before you go down there. Right? Yeah. And it's like, what? Can I not just wear a hat? I mean, the idea of being surgically altered before picking up this mission, I hope that surgery was light and not particularly invasive.
It seems like it was. Easy to do, easy to reverse, easy to do again.
And of course, it's sort of crazy to think that surgery actually would be easy. It's a major cranial augmentation for Worf to turn into a flat-headed forehead guy.
Oh, I don't know. Wait a second, because he wore the hat. He did wear a hat. The only thing I see that changed was his nose.
Well, I don't know if he ever exposed his forehead, I suppose, but yeah, it's still sort of hard to believe. Yeah. Plus, of course, with 24th century technology, you don't even need surgery. You could just wear some kind of holographic face, right? And I mean, we do it on Zoom all the time. Just put a filter over your face. I can imagine in the future they'd have something like that.
Okay.
Well, actually, they had that in Discovery, right? In the last couple of episodes of the last season, where they went over to the holographic ship thing, or whatever that was. But yeah, I like just the way it's so. Prepare yourself for surgery is such a kind of incidental line that I would have personally said no. And then you obviously know that Klingons have the back ridges as well, and all sorts of other stuff that might have been under clothes. I would have preferred to have a woody hat, given the option.
Was it? There's somebody out there that makes Star Trek parody songs. I forget his name, but he made a parody song. The original song was Celebration Time, and his parody was Augmentation Time. Just a song about how we're constantly seeing Star Trek characters get augmented to go underway or to go undercover like this. It's sometimes a bit ridiculous.
But sounds interesting.
This is the first time that Michael Dorn has appeared on Star Trek without, the Klingon makeup. But he still has a little bit of prosthetics, and it'll be another few years before you see Michael Dorn completely without prosthetics on Star Trek. But that does happen.
Far Beyond the Stars or something like that?
Yes, that one.
That's all right. I'm looking forward to that. Okay.
So
go ahead.
So, James, you mentioned, this story would have been all right if it was, Worf's foster uncle instead. It is sort of interesting that Paul Sorvino is like 13 years older than Michael Dorn. He does look really old compared to Worf, right? Mm-hmm. I know he's an older brother, but it wasn't supposed to be that much older. And this is not a character that is completely out of the blue. The Foster brother was mentioned before, way back in the first season in Heart of Glory.
The soccer match?
No, that's not later.
Okay.
We don't learn about that until Deep Space Nine episode, much later.
Okay. Years now.
And then I don't think the Foster brother was mentioned during that event, but it is sort of interesting. I did, there's this tension between these brothers who grew up together. They were fairly close in age, apparently. And Nikolai was the really crazy one who didn't follow the rules. I can see that, right? Especially with what we learn later about Worf and how he accidentally killed a kid on the soccer. And he became very controlling, right? And he's always been that way. He's always been a very controlled person, you know? Especially for a Klingon. Guinan pointed it out to him. Other Klingons laugh. You never laugh.
I do not feel like laughing.
So... yeah, it's sort of an interesting thing. But yeah, I mean, the Foster brother and the fact that he did not succeed in Starfleet was mentioned way back in the first season episode. What was sort of interesting back then was, though, Worf's family was from a farming colony called Galt.
Yes.
And yet that was never mentioned again. And, you know, retroactively, it seems like Worf's family was always from Russia or someplace. And anyway. But.
Well. Yeah, the Russian accent. So, obviously, Nikolai was also adopted.
What? Was he?
Why?
Why did you say that?
Foster brother?
No, but that's because Worf was the one that was adopted.
Yeah. They could have just said adopted brother. I don't know. Foster implies that there was not a fully completed adoption process, right? It was just like, hey, you fostered together. But then again, maybe that's true. Maybe Worf wasn't completely legally adopted, because how would the Federation have talked to the Klingon Empire to make that legal?
Yeah, there's a lot of paperwork to sort out, yeah. Especially when you have to have the translation back and forth into Klingon. It's a lot of hassle.
Okay. Yeah, you know, this Foster brother. You know, he'd been mentioned back in the first season, and then Peter David wrote some books with the Foster brother that actually tells the story about Worf and the Foster brother going to the academy together, and then eventually the brother not liking it there because it was too controlling and leaving. Those books were written after the first season, but before this episode. So, you know, Peter David used a different name for the Foster brother because it hadn't been established yet. In this episode, but that's sort of a cool use of the character. I thought it's interesting that Nikolai has gone off to become a doctor, an anthropologist. Does that seem like the kind of job that somebody would get into if they hate the rules and just they're a rebel? Those rebellious anthropologists.
Oh yeah. Yes, they are.
Chakotay is into that kind of stuff too, right? He just seems like such a rebel. No, not at all.
No. Okay, so he has a plan. He wants to create a pot. What is it? A pocket of area that the storm won't hurt them, and then they eventually will just be beamed to their new planet. But nope. Since we were going to leave, Nikolai decides to just beam the entire group right up into the holodeck as they slept. And they made a point to say, I beamed them up as they slept. So that way, none of them were any the wiser. However, when it's time to beam them down to the new planet, they just put them in their little tents, beam the whole tent down. How did they not know?
There was magic going on. They knew it at the time, right?
Sure. Yeah,
the Seer Worf is saying the magic words, which are apparently Commander Energize. It's the magic words, and a magic thing happens, and then there was a storm going on. It's easily distractible.
Yeah.
So what was the plan, by the way, on the planet? They were going to put the dome over the village and what, just leave it like that forever?
Yeah.
That was his plan. Yeah. That seems like it's short-sighted, right?
Well, no, wait. You mean that they weren't planning to transport them somewhere?
No, I didn't get the impression they were. I thought they were going to put a dome over it in order to protect them, and then just, go about their business for the next millennia. I mean, it just seemed like it wasn't, it didn't have a proper end game to it, that one.
Yeah, I think Nikolai had a number of different plans. I mean, retroactively, he states that he had thought about the holodeck movement concept before the ship even arrived. And yet, at the same time, when he first comes up to the ship, he suggests doing the protective dome concept, right? And then, but then falls back to his other plan. It might have been just him saying something to mislead Pard and everybody. I don't know.
Oh,
he's
definitely
a person that wants to his things his own way. He doesn't mind not being completely honest with people.
Yeah. He had to figure there's no way Picard would go, yeah, let's do that. Let's put a dome over it. I don't think so. Okay. All right. Well, I guess that's it. Really, this was, it just, other than just back and forth about the problem, it's really the whole thing. They have this planet. The planet's dying. It's got 38 hours to go. There are people there. We must let them die because of the Prime Directive. No, I'm not going to let them die. Okay, yes, I'll go ahead and let them die. Oh, but can I use your computer? I want to, bring up all my notes. No, I'm sorry. I brought up my notes, but they're in the forms of humanoid bodies that are currently on Holodeck 5. Let's go ahead and make it our way. Oh, while we're going, the holodeck breaks down. Yeah. Imagine that. The holodeck had problems along the way.
Well, that was set up in the very beginning. Early on, Data announced that they were going to have power failures and system failures, right?
Mm-hmm.
To help the writers threw it in to help out, I'm sure. But
So there's, there's that. And, they were able to, one of them walks off the holodeck. I guess that is kind of important. He walks off on the holodeck, finds his 24th century technology, and it's way too much for him to handle. He's freaking out there. What am I going to do? I can't go back. I can't tell these people. What am I going to do?
But it's not important, right?
No.
So that particular escapade isn't important in the way that he also dies by the end and no one cares because... either the people on the other side of the holodeck, as in our characters, they never knew him and he was a dead anyway. Mm-hmm. And the people on the holodeck, as in the village, they thought he got lost on his way anyway. So, they've also moved on and now, very traumatized. I have to say, this episode's a strange one because what it is that I think it's like one big question, which is about, do you interfere, that gets Picard's hand is forced. And as soon as his hand is forced, there's only kind of one way you can end this, right? You have to go and take them to another planet. And then what I think that they were trying to do is that, during the journey, yes, there's a little bit of tension about, oh, is it going to all go work out? Is the holodeck going to break or not? But realistically, we don't expect the holodeck to cause such problems that, this plan doesn't work. So at that point, what you fall back on in terms of the backbone of the story is the relationship between Worf and Nikolai. And I imagine what they were trying to go for is some kind of story that is able to use these events as a shining example as to why these two brothers were clashing heads or were doing things different or, whatever the situation might have been. And by the end of the episode, they resolve their conflict and each of them learns and goes forward. Now, I have to say, I don't think that any of that interaction between Worf and his brother works, or at least I'm not interested in it. Maybe that makes me a bad person. Mm-mm. But I think fundamentally the question here, which is the one that is forced within the first 10 minutes, which is, what do you do in this situation? I think that's a relatively interesting one, right?
Yeah, well, what would you do in the situation? Like I said, I don't know if I could just stand there and watch a planet with lots and lots of people on there just dissolve itself and everybody dies. Oh, well, let's head off to Starbase, whoever. So yeah, I could see the problem with that.
So by the way, at what point did the Prime Directive become? Look, I appreciate the idea of not interfering, right? As in, not going down to, you know, a bit like they did in Errand of Mercy, right? Where you go down to a primitive planet, you try to get them on your side, you use them as a pawn in the Cold War between the Klingons and the Federation. Mm-hmm. I understand why you would have something to prevent that. But at what point did that kind of philosophy evolve into, you know, there's an asteroid on the way, we can't be bothered to move it? Or we're studying this particular planet, and we're now going to say, look, if they're going to get wiped out entirely, then whatever. Because I think those things are different. Are they not?
Oh, yeah. I think they're, yeah, quantifiably different. And I would say it happened, Pen Pals, TNG, second season. Like, that's the first time that decision was made differently, I think. Mm-hmm.
Dream of Four.
In all the original series episodes, it was done differently. I see two big distinctions here, and that's one of them. And the other one is, you know, after the situation is forced on Picard, James, just a moment ago, you said there was only one way to end this. And maybe from a writer's perspective, from a next-gen writer's perspective, but in reality, I don't think that's true. And I think there was another choice, and one that the characters and the writers didn't make. And I still have a problem with that.
So, what do you mean by that? What wasn't looked at?
Okay, well, I guess I have a lot to say about both of these. But yeah, let's start with that one, right? So if you're in a situation where somebody's already forced your hand, right? People are already on board. And do you have a choice to send them back to their death or allow them to live? And then where do you allow them? I mean, obviously, we're going to choose to allow them to live. Let's help them to live if that's what it takes. But then the choice that the characters seem to make is, well, let's try to find a place that's very much like where they came from to allow them to keep their culture or whatever. But here's my main problem with it. They're making the decision for these people. Everybody in the show is making the decision for the people instead of giving the people agency to make it for themselves, right? They're treating these people like children, like infants, like, you know, people not able to choose for themselves. They're being racist. They believe that these beings are incapable of making decisions for themselves just because they're not technologically sophisticated in some way.
I think it's deeper than that, because the fact that he's actually, well, for all intents and purposes, married to one of them and impregnated her. So, of course, he's going to want to try and save them. He can't just save her.
Yeah, I mean, I have my problem with Nikolai's motivation too, right? He looks a little better than the other characters, than Picard. But even his motivation is selfish and racist, right? Because there's that moment when he finds out that Vorin has left the holodeck and might come back in and share the truth with the people. And he's chagrined about that. He does not want this society to change for personal reasons, right? For whatever reason, he likes the culture the way it is, right? And I think part of that reason is because in this culture, he has power.
Yep, he's our god.
He's a godlike creature. I mean, he doesn't... It's funny how he doesn't portray himself as a seer, right? Worf is the seer. And yet, you know, Nikolai certainly could have portrayed himself as a seer. It's sort of funny how he doesn't do that. He portrays himself as a leader. But he wants control. He wants to have that control. Even at the end of the episode, you know, there's that moment where he says, hey, I'm growing up, I'm becoming mature, I'm going to stay here and take care of this child that I've produced. I'm going to be a father, and that's going to make me an adult, respectable person. Like, no, you're going to be a bad father, because much like everybody else on this planet, you're probably going to expect your kid to do exactly what you want, not what that person wants, right? There's no acknowledgement of the agency of these individual sentient beings. I mean, there's a whole scene where Dr. Crusher and Data are making a decision for them on what planet they should live on. And Crusher's like, you know, it's sort of an overwhelming decision. You know, Data says, yeah, it's a big responsibility. No, it's not. Stop making decisions for these people. They are their own being. Go just talk to them. Let them decide in some way.
Are you sure about that? Because one of them committed suicide, finding out that there's much more than they know of. Wouldn't they all freak out? They have found out they're in the 24th century starship.
So I think that's that. I think that's why that character was written in there, is so that we would feel afraid of that possibility, right? Quite frankly, I think it's a cheat, right? I think the writers are doing that to try and get you on their side, right? Yes, it is possible that major upheavals in your worldview might lead some people to commit suicide, right? But I think the urge to live for most people is going to be stronger than that. Like that guy, Voren, I mean, he was particularly wrapped up in his role as the chronicle of his village, right? He talked about, you know, when he first found out what was going on, he's like, how could we possibly have a future if everything that made us is gone, right? He was always focused on this chronicle, right?
Can I just jump in here? Yes. I found that was a really odd sentence to, you know, that sentence was mentioned by that character, and it almost, you know, it was written in a way where it stumped everyone, right? I think it was Picard that was talking to him, and then he makes that statement, and then Picard is like stumped. It's like, oh yeah, well, you know, you must be right. Whereas I thought it was like a complete, I don't think it was in any way a valid concern to have, right? I mean, I just feel that, you know, the idea of, you know, even if you have, you know, even if everything about what you've been used to changes, that's no reason to throw everything away. I just didn't feel like that was a good enough reason for, you know, for everyone apparently to feel like, you know, they've been bested by the argument. I found that to be an extremely weak kind of argument.
Especially when you consider, like, Voren is the one saying it. And just 5 minutes earlier, what was Voren saying to Worf? He said, quote, "The Chronicle is the life of our village," right? Like, okay, the Chronicle still exists. You have it in your hand right there, right? How can you say that everything that made you who you are is destroyed? Part of it's with you. Part of it will always be with you. You learn, you move on, right? I mean, obviously, this character is a bit childish, does need a little hand-holding, right? Mm-hmm. But to believe that every single person in that holodeck, every single Borallan in that holodeck would behave in the same way or need the same handholding is racist. Yeah, it is a bad way. And even Picard and the way he treats Voren, right? Later on, when they're in Voren's guest quarters, right? And Voren's thinking about, hey, I want to go back to my people because that's what I know. I think Picard is sort of, you know, through words, because that's what Picard uses most of the time, right? I think he's sort of pressuring this kid to want to not return home, want to not upset the life that came before. In some ways, I think Picard was instrumental to this kid taking his own life. I look badly on Picard, you know? Why was the kid left alone so much? You know, I mean, this is a major thing. Why wasn't Troy in there talking to him or, you know, spending more time with him? You know, I think here's a big picture thing, right? These are tough, tough decisions. Dr. Crusher acknowledges it. It's a tough thing. Having a major upheaval, a major change in your society, a major environmental change, these are tough decisions. And the show the characters, the 24th century Starfleet Prime Directive, like, they all want things to be easy. They want easy black and white. And they glom behind the idea of non-interference. And that's the answer. If we're interfering, then we're going to not go that way. And, well, I'm sorry, but life is more complicated than that. And what is interference anyway?
Yeah, I was going to ask a question like that, too. I'm just going to preface a question, so go ahead and I'll ask it.
Yeah, I mean, Crusher alludes to it early on in the conference room, right? Where she says, you know, every single interaction we have, every single thing we do in life is interfering in some way, right? Mm-hmm. We do not, as sentient beings in the universe, we do not have the right, the absolute right, to never be interfered with, right? In that sense, right? When you exist in the world, other people exist. You're going to bump up against them. You're going to be exposed to new ideas. What I think the Prime Directive should be about, and what I think it was much more about in the original series, was not about non-interference. It was, the real issue is agency. The real issue is non-coercion. Right? Mm-hmm. Stop making decisions for the other person.
Okay. So I guess my question was, the Prime Directive deals with, if I understand it correctly, it's non-warp capable civilizations. If they are not warp capable, we do not interfere. So if there are millions of them are going to die, that's the way it is. However, if they're warp capable, well, then we need to step in. Why do we draw that distinction?
Well, they use that threshold as, I mean, I think a lot of what Data said is correct, by the way. I think they use the threshold here effectively to state that a bunch of, you know, the alien race has moved beyond its kind of child phase, during which you're not supposed to interfere, you're not supposed to give them agency, you're not supposed to ask them about anything, towards them being kind of treated as a grown-up, at which point, right, you know, we go down for first contact, we say, hey, you know, what's up, like we did in the episode First Contact, and if they say, look, we don't want to see you guys, then we go away. So I think it's really about the, you know, it's almost like the legal age. It's when someone turns 18 and then they're allowed to do something, and we treat them, we stop treating them like children, and we're expected to treat them like adults.
Yeah. I think that the whole concept of childhood versus adulthood is very key to this, right? And using a technological threshold as the defining feature of whether somebody's a child or an adult is just wrong, right? That's the wrong way to think of it, right? I mean, just say, think about the vastness of the timeline of the galaxy, right? Or the universe or any particular solar system, right? So a natural disaster is happening on a planet, right? Comets coming in or whatever the heck is happening on this planet, which seems totally made up science. I don't know any real science that would cause this kind of thing to happen, but whatever it is, right? So that natural disaster, is when would it happen in time? All right, it's pretty random. The Data says that this is a pretty random event, right? So if you look at the timeline and the period of the catastrophe versus the timeline and period of the sentient being evolving and then getting sophisticated enough to get off planet, right? That it's insignificant, right? Mm-hmm. You think about a comet coming hurling towards the Earth about to destroy the 20th century Earth versus a comet coming towards Earth in the 22nd century, where we can just leave the planet, right? The difference in time and the difference in technological sophistication is pretty insignificant compared to the history of the universe. So why are we using that as the defining factor about whether or not to help somebody out, right? I think it's pretty irresponsible, right? And the funny thing is, this happened a couple times in the original series. The big one is, for the world is hollow and I have touched the sky, right? Mm. whenever you have these society-ending, world-ending events, you interfere. You know, you interject. And you give the people knowledge. You give them agency to decide for themselves what they want to do. That's what happened in that episode. Kirk and Spock said, yeah, hey, you're part of a bigger world. And you're all about to die unless you do something. And then let them decide.
All right, so your solution is if there's a planet in distress, we will save them every time.
No, so Lou, actually, one second, I've got a child here. Gobsess. So the question I have here is that, you know, the proposal that Data's put forward, what's the downside to that?
Yeah.
I mean, so I understand that, you know, you could do an whataboutism, which is, oh, are you going to save every comet for every civilization always? No, maybe not. Maybe some will get through. Maybe you're not going to have a perfect, you know, a bowling record here. But what's the downside in every now and again when you find an asteroid that's hurtling towards a planet, just nudge it out of the way a little?
Yeah. Now, I think you both bring up good points. So number one is resources, right? How difficult is it to do? If it's just nudging an asteroid out of the way and in exchange you can save an entire civilization, then again, you are not morally obligated to do it. You didn't cause that asteroid to be hurtling towards that planet, but it would certainly be morally praiseworthy to take a small amount of action to save a bunch of people. Now, in some cases, maybe your resources are limited. Maybe the situation's worse. Like, this wasn't an asteroid. It was apparently some kind of phenomenon that was not, it was not possible for them to stop it, right? Like, you remember back in Pen Pals, initially they didn't think they could stop that. But eventually Wesley somehow discovered a way to do it, right?
Of course, yeah.
Of course it was Wesley. And then they said, okay, well, now that it's within our resources, we're going to do that. Well, plus Picard changed his mind. Hey, maybe Nikolai could have just shown Picard some images of the people on the planet, right? Maybe that would have worked instead of... You notice how Picard doesn't interact with any of these people? Right? It's just like he did with Hugh. I know it doesn't really relate necessarily, but you know, back in Iborg, when there was a Borg on board and he did not want to feel sympathy for that Borg, he never went and saw the Borg until Guinan forced him to. So I think sometimes Picard gets a little uppity, right? And Data probably did the right thing back in Pen Pals to force the emotional situation and residence onto Picard by letting him hear Sarzenka's cries. Anyway, so that was a slight detractor. But yeah, so that's one big thing is resources. Now, most of the time, we're given to believe that Starfleet is incredibly resourceful, right? Earlier in this episode, I think it was James, it might have been Luke. One of you said, why aren't there a fleet of ships hanging around to help the younger races and protect them or whatever? Like, well, maybe we just don't have that many resources, right? Sometimes there are problems. There's an entire anthology. It was an original series anthology called Merely... I don't know if you guys know this one. Not Merely Human. It frustrates me. I can't remember the name. I could probably look it up. But there was an original series anthology written about one particular culture that the Enterprise was involved with. They decided to help out the culture and save them from a near disaster. And it took 30 years for the culture to really adapt and develop and you know, get in their new paradigm. Right. These are long, hard, difficult decisions and long, hard, difficult outcomes. It's not an easy thing. Maybe you don't have the resources. But the other big thing I wanted to point out is something that Data sort of pointed out in this episode, where he says, we cannot offer guarantees. We can just make the best choice in the moment. Right. So, again, okay. I'm just reiterating the fact that these are hard decisions. It might not be the right thing, but you make the best decision you can.
So what if you Okay, so if you don't have the resources to actually help the civilization that you just saved, are you saying that it's best just to save them and then be on your way and let them find their own path again? Because it sounds like if they were fated to die one way, they're going to be fated to die another way. Maybe they'll develop some kind of nasty disease in the future that then, you know, they come into contact with us again, or and they, you know, they start killing our people, or like Picard says, you know, the next Adolf Hitler. But here's the thing. The pre-warp civilization could produce an Adolf Hitler just as much as a warp civilization can as well.
Yeah.
So why help one but not the other?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. You know, I mean, after Vorin committed suicide in this episode, Picard says, I wish he could have been a better bridge between bridge the gap between our cultures, right?
Yeah.
So yes and no. I mean, that's the thing about bridging the gap, right? The whole Prime Directive was originally written into Star Trek to try and counteract the impulse for imperialism that exists in the human culture, right? Mm-hmm. James, the British Empire has some bad history on that. Sorry.
But this is exactly where I think it's coming from, right? I think so first of all, that, you know, during the 60s, you obviously had the US and Russia getting into proxy wars, right? By, you know, in various theaters around the world. You also have, you know, the shadow of the British Empire, where you go and find, you know, uncivilized planets and effectively colonize them and get them, you know, bring them up to your standard. You know, all of this stuff, I think it's, that's very clearly instances of us not wanting to do that. It's just, I find it odd that there's the jump from that over towards this idea of if there's a plague that's going to rip through the planet, or if there's going to be an asteroid that's going to wipe out the planet, then you turn, you know, you look the other way. And Lou, you did mention about, okay, what's the difference between a warp capable species versus a non-warp capable species? I mean, I do think it comes back to this child versus adult, and you know what Data was mentioning. We don't respect the agency of non-warp capable civilizations, so mm-hmm. we are not prepared to ask them. And to the extent that they can ask for help through, I don't know, prayer or something, we're not willing to answer them. And I think that that's, I don't think that's a great position for, a great philosophical position for Star Trek to take.
Okay.
Or the Federation to take.
Yeah. I think I was trying to talk about bridging the gap between cultures. So let me finish up that thought and then we'll come back to this new one. In our history, right, whenever you had a more technologically sophisticated culture like the British Empire coming over to North America, eventually, you know, there was a racist belief that we need to bring the Native Americans up to our culture, right? And of course, that was wrong. That was wrong thinking. But the reality of it is sometimes people think that the Native American culture was entirely decimated. But in reality, what happens when two cultures collide, hopefully we can do it more peacefully with less death and loss of agency, of course. But ultimately, we came to some new culture that was in the middle, right? We have adapted ideas that the Native Americans had, right? I mean, like the colonists from Britain eventually learned things that Native Americans, the whole, turkey and Thanksgiving and other farming mechanisms and things. Like, there were parts of the Native American culture that were absorbed into the colonists that came over to ended up founding the United States. So I'm just saying that's true in all cases, right? When two cultures meet, both of them end up getting destroyed in some way. But it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. The other thing that you guys are talking about, do we help all cultures or not help any culture? I think it also has to do with the level of problem, right? Or who caused the problem. There was a little bit of talk about this. I know Dr. Pulaski talked about it a bit back in the Pen Pals episode, where, number one, you know, if the problem is self-imposed or caused by the society themselves, then, you know, we have less moral reason to get involved. But the other thing is, there is a big difference between a problem that's going to wipe out 90% of the culture and a problem that's going to absolutely wipe out all of them. Right?
Elaborate.
Well, because evolution, and I know in some sense cultural evolution doesn't really exist, not in the same way that biological evolution exists, but certainly biological evolution works because there's an environmental change, right? Some environmental change has happened and some significant percentage of the population dies because of it or isn't able to populate into the next generation. And therefore, some subset of that first generation becomes the only set in the next generation. That's how evolution works, is that, you know, there's some subset of the population that is more capable of surviving, right? So if the change in the environment, number one, if it wasn't caused by us, okay? But number two, if it's not going to destroy a significant amount of the inherent population, then there may be a good logical reason to say, well, we should allow that to happen. Or we don't have as much of a moral impetus to interject, because that is sort of a natural phenomenon. Now, I definitely do not want people to misunderstand me and think that I think just because something's natural that it's right, right? Captain Janeway made that mistake when she talked about the Prime Directive in, I can't remember what episode it was, where she said extinction is sometimes the natural end to evolution, mm-hmm. right? Which is technically true, but not really an accurate depiction of what evolution is. And again, biological evolution isn't necessarily the same as cultural evolution, but I do think there's an important distinction to be made there, right? Ultimately, the decision's should be made by individuals who are knowledgeable about the situation as best they can, who understand the resource limitations and the probabilities involved. that gets into another question. Who's going to make these decisions, right? Yeah. And the best person to make any decision is the one closest to the problem, right? Okay. So it wasn't a factor in this episode, but sometimes there's Prime Directive episodes where they say, well, we can't really decide. We'll let Starfleet decide, or we'll let the Federation Council decide, you know? And I think that is another out that they have sometimes in the writing that I don't really like.
That makes sense.
So Data, the example that you have there about the the difference between the entire race disappearing versus, you know, there being substantial changes in the race or in society, I mean, that was very much the situation they put forward on the Enterprise episode, right? Is it Doctor's Orders or Dear Doctor? One of those, I can't remember which one it was, but it was the one about it was the one about that you have a setup where, I mean, for want of a better word, you almost had like two classes within the society, and there was a biological shift taking place from one to the other. And it was put out from the perspective of a genetic or a biological issue, but it could also have been sociopolitical as well. And I do kind of agree that you don't want to be running in to be dealing with those kind of changes, because I don't particularly want to see the Federation place itself as the protector of the status quo, right? When there are changes in society, however they're coming about, you kind of do, you know, I think you're fighting a losing battle if you feel like you always have to maintain the status quo and you resist resist every single change that is going to occur. So I certainly would say that, you know, in the idea of, you know, protecting places out there, I wouldn't go as far as saying that you have to go out and protect the status quo, protect the institutions as they currently exist, whether it's, you know, whether they're using the races as a stand-in for socio-political setup or not. But yeah, I think that was really what they were. That was supposed to be like the first episode that described where this whole non-interference stuff came from. And I think that particular example is a very different example to what, you know, to almost a very clear-cut asteroid heading into planet. Why did you nudge it off course? I can't understand why anyone would ever object to doing that.
It's funny you should mention that, James, because, I think Homeward is, among TNG episodes, the worst example of the Prime Directive being enforced in a bad way. I think Dear Doctor, the episode you're referring to over on Enterprise, is probably the worst example in the entirety of Star Trek of the Prime Directive. I actually really disagree with the decision that was made in that episode by the characters, but maybe for a slightly different reason. In that episode, it's about time scale, right? The Doctor's saying, well, if we leave them alone over millions of years, they will evolve differently, right? Well, that's true of everybody we run into, right? We cannot be making our decisions based on what's going to happen millions of years from now. Otherwise, what's the point of Starfleet even being out there? Because millions of years from now, we're all going to be different.
Yeah.
You know? So you have to focus on the people that are alive now. And in that episode, the society that was alive at the time was about to die. Right. And yeah, it had problems. It had social divides and racist problems, right? With the more technologically sophisticated part of society holding down the other part of society. That's something to deal with. But you don't deal with it by just saying, oh, yeah, well, we're going to let the more technologically sophisticated people die. All of them. Right. I don't know.
Okay.
I like your take on that, James. The idea of maintaining the status quo. I think maybe that is something that the Prime Directive has come to be looked at, right? Some of the writers say, well, we need to leave them alone. We need to maintain the status quo. We need to not get involved, right?
Okay.
What's the one constant in life? The one constant in the universe is that there will be change. Allow change to happen. The most important thing is who's gonna be making the decision on which way we're gonna change. And I think it's about agency, and it's about not coercing people and making decisions for them.
Cool. Okay. I guess we're good on it then.
We got right into the heavy stuff. And maybe there's a little more to talk about that. But I also have pages of little funny bits that we never got to talk about.
Oh god, let's hear some fun parts.
Let me see. Just early on, when they find out that there's no one at the post, Riker says it's not like him to leave the post. It's not like him. Does Riker know Nikolai?
That's a good, I thought that too.
You know, or is he just saying anthropological doctors in general don't act this way? I don't know. Because when Worf goes down to meet him and they first run into each other, Nikolai says, you've changed a lot in 4 years, right? So, like, when was the last time they saw each other? So, four years ago was around the time of the episode Family, right? The Enterprise was on Earth. We know Worf's parents came up to visit him. We didn't see his brother at the time, but it's very possible that there was another interaction where maybe Worf's brother came on board the Enterprise at that time. Maybe. I don't know. Huh. Just a little thing. Worf, throughout this episode, is very clearly very well, he's very Worf, right? Worf is very much the quintessential, like, he loves things that are black and white. He loves the honor, and he hates subterfuge. He hates difficult decisions. So many great little moments where he's pleading, please don't do this, or like, oh my God, you're going to force me to be involved in the Shroud, right? These are the lines of LaForge, right? Just Worf's face when he has to.
Oh, yeah.
I found that funny in a couple different places.
Give me too much credit to LaForge.
When they're going to investigate, after the power outage, right before Worf finds out that the people have been moved to the holodeck, right? So he goes down to deck 10, and he's investigating, and he goes up to the holodeck where he thinks the problem is. And he asks to get inside, and the computer actually says no, because the holodeck's in use. Since when does the computer not let people in when the holodeck's in use? We saw so many other times where people just walked into each other's holodeck programs. Maybe there's been an upgrade for security purposes.
I mean, in fairness, I think it's more appropriate for it to say you can't come in than just let Wesley wander into your holodeck program.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Or to accidentally wander into Geordi's holodeck program.
Yeah,
I'm sure on the record there was an unfortunate incident that took place has now redefined the protocol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, things that you just can't unsee once you've seen them. And Geordi on the holodeck is one of them.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, didn't we all cringe when he and Christy were on the beach in the holodeck? I'm like, oh, this doesn't work.
He's adorable.
Poor girl. Look what she's got to go through. But it worked. In the end, he ended up with her somehow. So, whatever.
I like how Voren talks about how he's only able to save the last 6 records of the Chronicle. Right? Uh-huh. And then he lost one, and he went back for it, and... So down the group, the village group, went down to 5, apparently. And then they finally get to the planet at the end of the episode, and Worf asks to take one of the 5 with him. And his brother Nikolai, who's supposed to be the new Chronicle, like, one of your big jobs is to protect the Chronicle. And he's like, yeah, I'll just let you take 20% of what we have.
Sure, on your first day.
Good job there, new Chronicle.
Actually, one thing I found interesting, I liked, is that they mention when they're doing the spiel about, okay, we're going to go to a new land and we're going to have to settle in this new place because that village has been destroyed, and Worf mentions there might even be, we might even be under new stars. And then one of them calls him up and he goes, what do you mean, under new stars? What would that be? And he kind of like gets left like that. But it's like, well, why would they be on the new stars? I mean, for all you know, the new planet's going to have a completely different sky. And, 3 moons all of a sudden. I mean, they're not going to be that stupid not to notice.
You'd think. I mean, they only travel, 7 blocks?
Yeah. I walked through this cave, went into Narnia, and then and also the other thing that they have, they're walking all of the way, right? At no point does anyone say, no, here's good. Well, what's wrong with here?
Yeah.
No, because the leader says that we have to go further, because I wanted to ask about that too. Why did they have to climb a freaking mountain? Why couldn't they just take them on a straight and nice, easy path to there?
Well, you had to imagine that they had to start with the terrain that the villagers already knew. And eventually, they had to incorporate the terrain of the new place just to make it a bit gradual. So you would have to use some of the natural terrain. I don't know.
So what's to prevent the people from just backtracking where they were?
I would have made it complete.
Find that they got lost, apparently, because it just doesn't look the same as it did during the storms.
Uh-oh.
So I would have made it completely crazy. Like, in the cave, create like a 2,000-foot slide to go down just so there's no chance of them going back up the way they came.
It's funny you mentioned the big differences in these two planets, right? The stars being one, but the biology being another one. Like, Dr. Crusher even mentions it when she says, you know, we don't know if the new system, how they're going to respond to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Like, there might be something that they're allergic to or that kills a number of them. Or yep. And then, but then she also takes the opposite track. She also says, what's the impact going to be on the Vakan system, right? Like, she's also worried about the environment of the Vakan system. We're having this new virus of the Varalans infecting the Vakan system. So, you know, again, it's interesting, like, that weighing those challenges, right?
Well, it's better than being taken over by the Cardassians. That would have been fun to see.
Yeah, I don't know. Do you guys know what happened later on to these people? Of course, nothing in official canon, but you know there was a...
Oh, I'm not aware, no.
There was a comic book series that was set later on. And, they didn't have a problem with the Cardassians, but they did have a problem with another race. And most of these people ended up dying, according to the comic.
What race is that?
I think it was Klingons, but I can't remember.
Or Ferengi.
It's been a while since I read that one.
All right.
But whatever. It's just a comic book.
Yeah. A couple of the women were forced to serve Quark on his double table. Who knows?
Women, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure, we've already pointed out a lot of racism in this episode. Let's point out some sexism, too. There's that moment where the Vorin guy goes off to look for the chronicle that he left in the caves, which, of course, why did Worf let him go off by himself, right? Ridiculous. Oh, well, Worf was distracted right at that moment. He was distracted by an old man who needed help. Okay, that's fine. He was also distracted by a good-looking woman that walked by. You see that leer that Worf gave that woman? And then... And then the guy says, yeah, that's my daughter. And I'm taking care of her right now because she's my daughter. But if I die, then she'll definitely need a husband, right? Whatever. There's some sexism there, obviously.
Kapla.
I also find it interesting how that old guy said, I'm glad she was old enough to survive the storms. And then it might occur to you, oh, yeah, there are no kids here. Like, this is a small village.
Oh, man, that's messed up.
There would have been kids. So all of the kids died.
Like, they got left behind.
Like, Nikolai was working with these people. Like, the storms had been happening for weeks, or at least days, and Nikolai chose to go help them. And did he purposely choose the ones he wanted to help? Oh, well, that could be really troublesome when you think about it. I think they just didn't want to have to work with kid actors. And so they threw in this line that sort of says, oh, yeah, by the way, all the kids died off screen. No Shorzhenkas here.
Okay, then.
Is that too heavy? I thought it was a bit funny. Sorry.
I never thought of that idea. Why were there no kids there?
No, it's clearly because they don't want to have kids on set, right?
Yeah.
Also, you know, no wild stock, you know. Surely a village like that would have had some, you know, you don't know exactly what kind of relationship they would have had to animals, but again, you would probably expect that kind of thing also to be available or to be part of their daily life.
Okay. And it just has the right amount of oxygen for these people. Nobody had any breathing problems. All right.
Okay, are we going to mention anything about the fact that they reused this for Insurrection?
Yeah, in fact, I found an interesting thing on Memory Alpha about that. Do you know about that, James?
Oh, I don't. I think I mentioned last week that they effectively do the same story here in Insurrection. And by the way, the issue of the issue is also brought up in Insurrection when they finally, you know, when they get exposed. They do specifically mention that because they, you know, these guys are technologically advanced, there's no harm done to the development of society. Oh. So even then, there's an explicit statement that, hey, you know how to build a warp core, you can have agency. You don't, then you can't.
yeah, ridiculous. But yeah, I mean, the thing that made Insurrection worse than this, of course, was that there was nothing wrong with the planet in Insurrection, right? The people of Baku were being forcibly moved against their will, against their knowledge, against their agency, just because people wanted to steal the resources of the planet, right? The metagenic child, you know, youthful thing. So definitely a much worse of a moral problem in Insurrection. Definitely something that Data and Picard should stand up against. And they did. Yay. But in this case, right, you know, we're saying, yeah, we want to help these people. And well, Picard doesn't say that, but at least Nikolai is taking that stance. And then once Picard does get involved, you're like, yeah, we'll help them, but we'll try to minimize the interference as much as possible. I think that's laudable, right? Just saying, hey, you don't have to change your culture really much right now. It would be great if they gave them some agency to decide that. But yeah, so I don't think it's quite as bad, the use of the holodeck and the transportation, secret transportation kind of stuff here. But it's funny that concept of using the holodeck to move a society without their knowledge was behind the scenes referred to as the Sorvino switch, right? So it was, we're going to switch their planet on them without them knowing it. And they call it, behind the scenes, the writers called it the Sorvino switch as a homage to Paul Sorvino in this episode. But that's what they called it when they were writing and producing Insurrection. It's sort of funny. What else?
Well, then, I don't know. What else could there be?
I wondered if the use of the term brother might have been a little confusing for people. Like, when Worf first shows up on the planet and Nikolai says, oh, this is my brother. Like, Worf and Nikolai don't look a lot alike. I'm talking about skin tone here, but I don't know. But maybe it's translators, or the term brother can be used in many ways, so it doesn't necessarily mean much.
Well, but it is the 24th century, and since Sorvino is Italian and the Rozhenkos are Russian, I don't know. You never know.
I don't. Obviously, they had many different skin tone people on the planet, so probably not that big a deal. The idea of foster brothers and maybe religious brothers. There certainly seemed to be some religion involved on the planet.
I'm just talking about the Rozhenkos. I mean, clearly he couldn't have come from them. He looks nothing like them. I mean, so that's why I figured they were fostering Nikolai.
Mm-hmm.
And adopted Worf.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I don't think it was meant to be that way. I don't know about the casting of Paul Sorvino. I mean, it doesn't matter too much, but yeah, he doesn't really look like the people that they cast for Worf's parents, even though he's supposed to be biologically related to them. And he's much older than you would think, like I said, but I don't gripe about that kind of stuff too much. It's more about the story than it is the visual in my mind.
Right? Yep, I agree.
I find it funny how Worf took so long to pick up on the fact that Nikolai had a thing for that woman on the planet. Like, it was pretty clear to me from the beginning that they had a special relationship of some sort. Worf is just so clueless when it comes to so many things, including women.
But by the way, I have checked the date of birth of Worf's mother and the date of birth of Worf's brother, and his mum was born only 6 years earlier than his brother. And I'm talking about the actors here.
The actors, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how that works out sometimes. there's one little moment where Data in the episode says 9 1/2 instead of 9 1/2, 9 1/2 versus 9. I just thought that was weird the way he says that. Now we're getting in the minutia.
Yeah.
Minus two. All right. Anyway, how about this? So Nikolai forces Picard into this situation, right? And says, hey, now that the people are here, you're definitely not going to kill them, right? So you have the choice. Either give them agency and allow them to make a decision on their own, which neither of us wants. You don't want it because it's hard, Picard. And I don't want it as Nikolai because, for some reason, I want these people to be ignorant so that I could be their leader, right? Because I like that. Right. Anyway, that's not spoken. But anyway, anyway, so they say, well, here's the best situation we have. We're going to go do the Sorvino switch. And in less than 60 seconds, Picard says try twice. Like in his ready room, he says, yes, we'll try it. And then he goes down to the science lab and Geordi tells him about the problems they're having with the holodeck and like, well, we're going to have to try and work around this. And Picard says, okay, we'll try. It's just interesting that you don't often hear Picard be so wishy-washy, right? And using the word try, he's so much more like Yoda often, you know?
Okay.
Spoiler, not, but anyway.
The only last thing I have, I got to be honest, the last thing I have is why they left Nikolai on the planet. Just to continue making it worse. Because he impregnated one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised they left him to just carry on. Well,
what are they going to do? I mean,
take him off. It's not his world. He shouldn't be there.
Yeah. This is... So what we have here is conflicting moral values, right? And this is what Star Trek should be about. It should be about dealing with some hard decisions. And the Prime Directive is about that. There are conflicting moral values here. We want people to have agency, but at the same time, we don't want them to die. And when do we make the choices over life? You know, that... Nikolai says that at a number of places in here. Like, I see no honor in this. I want, it's more, there's something more important than abstraction. That's what he calls it. 15 minutes in, he says, this abstraction is not as important to me as life, right? Well, some abstractions, morality is an abstraction, some abstractions are more important than life. It's just a question of which ones. And so anyway, this relates to Nikolai being left on the planet because, you know, this is a conflicting value, right? Like he did wrong. He violated his oath as an anthropologist or a doctor or whatever. But at the same time, he's also a father. And we value fathers being around for their children. And so how do you make the decision? And apparently, it seems like the Starfleet is okay, that the father trumps the legality of the other things that we're going to put you in prison, which is
how are they compatible?
Yeah.
I mean, how would he have known that? You think maybe they got into bed and she said, oh, my God, what's that? Oh, sorry. I should have told you. I'm different. I don't know.
The fact that any alien races can interbreed is
wow.
You know, yeah. It's a Star Trek conceit.
Quit poking me in my brain. Oh, sorry. Can you tell me what that part is, Ben? Who knows? I mean, the fact that they could even conceive, it seems highly unlikely.
All right.
What's the baby going to look like? Because he's surgically altered, right? So what's our baby going to look like? It's not going to come out. Half, it's going to come out half human and half them. I forgot their name already.
The Borellans?
Borellans, yeah. It's going to come out half Borel and half human.
I wonder, they might rename the system they're in now.
Okay.
Where'd that name even come from? It was probably not even an indigenous name, right? Because the place is called Borel 2, right? The people. This is the same problem with the Malkor 3, right? The Malkorians, right? They probably don't call themselves that if they think they're the center of the universe. But anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Did they not have a full name?
I don't remember hearing anything, so no, I don't. All right, guys. Where are we at now? We're about done, or are we missing stuff?
No, I'm good. I'm good.
I'm pretty good.
Okay. It's
only so much of this that people can handle.
Yeah.
I thank you guys for allowing me to come on and talk about this stuff from time to time.
No problem.
This is a passion of mine. So thanks for giving me the outlet to share some thoughts.
So the passion, is it Star Trek or interfering with the natural evolution of worlds? Which passion are you talking about?
I'm talking about the Venn diagram overlap, right? I'm like, This is the overlap of so many things that I'm passionate about in my life, right? I like sci-fi. I love Star Trek. But I'm also really interested in power dynamics, right? That's as a parliamentarian and an election expert, and I work towards election reform. I work towards societies and helping people with their bylaws and running meetings. And like, so this is just a wonderful overlap of all of my interests. And thank you for letting me share it with you guys.
Hey, no problem. No problem. We come to the end of the series. Okay.
Have you guys talked about what you're doing next?
Oh, we don't know. You know, who knows if we're going to be alive in 3 years to make that plan?
What? Sorry?
At the rate we put out things, yes, it's probably going to be 3 years.
Well, I'm worried about this. Who knows if we're going to be alive? Kind of a rather flippant statement. I haven't sorted out my retirement plan yet. I hope to be around for at least more than 3 years.
Hope so too. I hope so too. Okay. Well, then I guess that brings us to the end of this one. So it's now time for our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being the worst and 5 being the best. Data, you start us out again.
Okay. Thank you. About halfway through the episode, there was a short scene between Worf and the Chronicle kid, the Vorin, and where Worf's like, "What is that?" And the Chronicle's like, "This is our Chronicle. It's important to us. We write things down because when you write things down, it doesn't change." And it's funny, Worf says, "Well, I do things differently. I create songs and stories." So Worf is from, we're having an allusion here to the Klingon culture. And the Klingon culture does value songs and stories. But supposedly the Klingon culture is the more technologically advanced one because they have warp drive. And yet this primitive culture on the planet uses written word to pass stories and pictures. I think it's just one of the examples of what does it mean to be technologically advantaged? Societies are just different. It doesn't make one better or worse than another just because they have discovered some particular technological thing, including warp drive. And I like this story because it brings up these concepts. I hate a lot of where it goes with it. Ultimately, I think the Prime Directive is the core question for all of life. It is the question of how do we all get along? Who's in charge in any particular situation? And those decisions should be made at the lowest level possible. Give people agency at the lowest level. That's why two of my personal core values are liberty, and balance, finding balance. Morality is about balance. Anything taken to extreme is immoral. So I applaud Star Trek for bringing up these important questions. And sometimes it falls flat like this episode. and that's unfortunate. I would rate it as a 2.
Okay, that's a 2. I'll be brief. It might be somewhat of a cute story. I kind of understand what they're getting at. I don't know if I could just drive away and watch in the rearview mirror as the planet just dissolves itself, knowing that how many people have died. That probably would have messed me up for a while. Still can't get over somebody not knowing that they just got beamed somewhere, sitting in a tent. And all of a sudden, it's not like the storm just kind of fizzled out. It just stopped. So, because that was Worf who did that. Yes, he's a great guy. But now Worf is gone. And what are the ramifications on this new planet? Uh-oh, we need Worf. Where is he? He was just here last month. Where is he now? That's never going to be answered. Is Nikolai a member of the Federation? If so, they never should have left him there. I don't understand why they would have done that. Because even Picard said his career is finished. What career? So, I'm surprised he just gets to stay with them. But, okay. In the end, it's not the greatest episode. I was thinking a high 2, maybe lower 3, so I'll just give it a 3. It could be better, a lot better, but it could be a lot worse. So I'll go for a 3. Doctor?
Hey, well, actually, first of all, what I'd like to say is I've really enjoyed this this discussion that we've had over the last hour and a bit. I think it has been very entertaining, and I do think that there are genuine questions to ask, and I think that, you know, at how and when do people interfere, for what reasons, and what are the controls around that? I don't feel like Star Trek gets into these issues that often. Everyone knows about the Prime Directive, but very often it's not really, the kind of like the hard questions are not explored, or at least maybe they are, and I just ignore those episodes. I have to say, I think that I've always had like a very low opinion of this episode. It's one of the ones I don't particularly care for. It's in a part of this season that is a little bit, it's not as great. There are certainly better episodes of TNG this year. But haven't kind of like rewatched it. I did find the rewatch to be quite pleasant. I enjoyed the episode. I enjoyed the question that it asks. I don't think it works in terms of once we have decided what we want to do, and there's basically, you have to make sure you get to the planet without the holodeck turning off. That's not particularly interesting. And I don't think they go through the relationship between Worf and his brother very well. There was a conflict there, but to be honest with you, I just don't feel like it gels. In the best case scenario, right, you would have had some kind of, personal relationship there that mirrored the overarching discussion that would have been happening in the show, and they would have all learned some nice moral lesson and moved on. But I kind of feel that the time with Nikolai and Worf is somewhat wasted. So where do I kind of come down? Where do I rate this? I would have sworn I would have been like at a 2 or so beforehand, but I really did enjoy watching it, and I did enjoy the discussion. So I was going to come in at a 3, Lou, but I don't know. Maybe I'm being too generous on what is a pretty mediocre episode here.
So I need to change the rating back down to a 2.
I think two is probably correct. Right? It's not much really. There's not huge. You wouldn't go out of your way and tell someone to watch this Star Trek episode to learn about what Trek is about, or right. What this isn't a good advert for Trek.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think.
Okay.
I mean, other than the fact we can sit here and talk about it for 90 minutes, yeah. And by the way, if you're saying like 48 hours away, right? Can they put like the entire village into a coma? I mean, couldn't they have got themselves into a position where they weren't threatened by the power being turned off of the holodeck.
Yeah, anesthesia, maybe. It depends on what their physiology is, since she couldn't wipe his memory.
Yeah. Well, the thing about wiping the memory, by the way, that's you know, we've been this route before, and we know that that's what... The fact that we're able to do it one time means that whenever it comes up again, they need to explain as to why they can't do it in exactly the same way that they have to explain why Troy is no longer an empath and why, you know, why Data is malfunctioning this week. It's just that they need to, you know, they would rather have not wiped the memory in the, or when was it? I suppose it was Pulaski, right? It was Pulaski who did it first.
Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, they opened up Pandora's box there, and they kind of can't get that genie back in the bottle. So they have to keep telling you each time that, something's going to go wrong with the memory wipe.
And speaking of genies in the bottle, what about just a couple episodes ago? They defined a warp speed limit, right? And yet here they are, they're going maximum warp to save a village. Right, there was no mention of violating the speed limit. Yeah, it's a little inconsistent sometimes.
No, I still feel like I think I mentioned it at the time, but I'm pretty sure that the warp speed limit, it given that we're like, you know, now at the latter stages of Series 7, with Voyager just about to launch, and Voyager has to get home, and they're 70,000 light years from Earth. It seems like, you know, a major like FU on that part. It's like, yeah, not only do you have to get home by going 70,000 light years, but you have to do it at warp 5.
Voyager should have given up and done something else, but that's a different discussion point.
Yeah, and I appreciate that the speculation in the fandom is that by the time Voyager came along, they had new engines or new engine geometries that meant that they didn't have this issue. So they were able to sidestep that. But that's actually quite nice, though, right? If they find a problem with the main form of propulsion and they fix it within 9 months, that's pretty good turnaround time.
Unrealistic, maybe?
Well, of course. Of course.
Let's see. Hey, by the way, I looked it up. The name of that anthology I was thinking of earlier that really deals with Prime Directive issues over a long period of time, it was called Mere Anarchy, right? So there was a planet that had a Prime Directive near extinction event like this, and it happened early in the original 5-year mission. Hmm. And then we keep going back and revisiting that same planet all the way up until, you know, 30 years later, right? Kirk and company keep going back, right? On the Enterprise, on other ships, right? So it's set in the original 5-year mission during the movies. It's cool.
Okay. All right. Anything else, guys?
No. I think we're all good.
All right.
Okay, so while you guys were talking, I just thought, I wonder. Star Trek Voyager had a 65-year journey that they were able to get done in 7 years. How long has our journey been?
So, our journey to where?
From Encounter at Far Point to here at this point, or to the end of this series. Do you want to know? Yeah, do you want to know?
I know full well. That it's 8 years now, right? It must be 8, or maybe even more.
7.
I mean, I've moved house and I've got a child now that walks around the house that wasn't even inside her mother's tummy at the time we started.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The first one of Encounter at Far Point, season 1, episode 1, was published on March 14th of 2014. My birthday on 2014. So yes, that has been 7 years. So we have it took us longer to get through. It is taking us longer to get through TNG than Voyager did. So yeah, we gotta find a wormhole somehow and get it done.
Honestly, it doesn't sound as bad when you say seven years to get through seven. Well, we've got through 6.5 years worth of TV in 7 years. It doesn't sound so bad. Although I appreciate
26 this. Episodes of a season. Okay,
I agree. I appreciate that we're on a different release schedule.
Definitely. Oh man, it's just worse anymore. Okay, but whatever. It is what it is. We'll see what happens for DS9. All right, Data, thank you for coming on. It's been great having you for the series.
We're going to stay on to do DS9 next. You hadn't decided.
We haven't. We've been talking about it. No, we're talking about it. And
Luke, I thought that you had decided and you hadn't. We're going ahead with it. And I was informed that I need to appear.
Well, I didn't draft you. I mean, certainly, you know, it's a big part. If you're not going to do it, I'm not going to do it. I'll tell you that. So, yeah, that is a definite my feelings on that. As in the last 7 years, I, you know, it all started when you responded to a forum post. Remember, and you know, hey, foolish. I like Star Trek, and you know, I like foolish to talk to you. Me. Yeah, it was silly of you, but you came on the Lutrek show. We talked to you, and I realized, you know, I like doing this with you. So if you're not going to, I'm not going to. Yeah, not with anyone else. We could bring on somebody, and we have talked about bringing on somebody, but still, if you're not going to, I will not. So we'll see, guys, how it goes. Start that letter campaign to Dr. James Roberts and tell him he must stay on. You want. So, all right. But again, Data, I'm not showing you anywhere. We got people for the rest of the series on. So, I'll start thinking about some DS9 stuff that you might want to be involved in. And when we make an announcement here shortly, we'll let you know.
Thanks, guys.
You bet. All right. Thank you. So, everyone, join us next time as we review episode number 14. Sub Rosa, and I promise I will be in a coma then, so you may not hear much from me. I may have to let James handle it. Oh no, James, we said we were gonna let the guests do this one by themselves. If they want to talk about Sub Rosa, they deserve to be on by themselves. Just let them handle it. It's one of the worst things, you know, beyond what Shades of Grey. Or at the absolute worst would be a Code of Honor, I suppose. Which, over the years...
There's nothing wrong with Code of Honor.
Which, over the years, I'm now looking at Season 1, our ratings, and I actually gave that a 2. So, I got a feeling the cancel culture is going to be taking us out because I gave that piece of garbage a 2.
Well, dude, you might not remember, but... Code of Honor was my first Star Trek episode I ever saw on TV. I remember it clearly because I remember the bit where they beam Tasha back to the Enterprise and, you know, all of that rigmarole about then saving the woman. Mm-hmm. You know, I specifically remember it. And yeah, it was the first episode of Star Trek I ever saw. And I thought it was awesome.
And no vault scene, no treaty, or whatever.
Well, I mean, obviously at the time I think I'm probably 10 or 11 or so, and I'm a bit of an idiot, but yeah, I do know that it was with almost certainty it was the first episode of Trek that I saw, and come on, you can't blame it for that.
Then right? would you like to change your 1-star rating to something higher then? Is that what you're trying to say?
No, obviously not. but it's still, you know, nonetheless, right? The nice flashing lights, the starship, and you know all of the stuff that goes on. It's not completely worthless.
at least that culture was given more agency than the Borallans in this episode.
Mm-hmm. All right, everyone, take care and good night.
Okay, good night.
Nighty night. Sleep tight.